This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Well, for most people, the holidays are a season of love, joy, and celebration of friends and family. For others, it can be a time of crippling depression and even thoughts of suicide. It is for this reason that this week on the Compass, we are bringing you the story of a woman who actually committed suicide, but miraculously survived not only to tell the tale, but to bring hope and help to others considering doing the same. So now, let's go inside the Compass. On May 11th of 2013, Michelle Fox of Port Angeles, Washington, wrapped herself in a blanket, stepped into her shower stall, and shot herself through the chest with a .357 Magnum revolver. In a result that was part miracle, but a major part heroic effort on the part of family and medical professionals, she survived the suicide attempt that has set the stage for a life which now includes trying to help others who reached the desperate crossroad that led her to her fateful decision to end her own life. Today on The Compass, KPTZ Toss Salad host Phil Andrus interviews Fox and her partner Darren Nikovich about suicide survival and the lessons learned.
What do you remember of the seconds after you pulled the trigger?
My oldest son actually broke down the bedroom door, and he was the first one to me. And all I remember is smelling gunpowder, hearing my son say, "Mom, are you okay?" I said no, and I blacked out. And I don't remember anything for at least 10 days.
So your son found you. How old was he then?
19. No, 18. I'm sorry.
And it was he who called 911.
No, actually, my 15-year-old son called 911. My 18-year-old son is the reason that I made it till the paramedics got there, because he put pressure on the wound and stayed there with me, even though, from what I'm told, my husband was trying to pull him off of me. He kept saying, "She's gone, just leave her." And Christopher wouldn't leave me. And because of his, you know, pressure on the wound, I was able to make it till the paramedics got there, and then they took over.
Briefly, you were conscious. Did you feel regret for what you had done?
What's strange is people ask me about that, and everything that I did in the last 5-10 minutes before I actually shot myself, it almost, to me, it was like watching myself do it. Like, I wasn't even there. And there was a, "Oh my God, what am I doing?" But it was too late at that point. But yeah, it was really like watching somebody else do it.
So. The weapon you used was a powerful one. Mm-hmm. The bullet that you used was a hollow point, which mm-hmm. means it was more destructive than another sort of mm-hmm. bullet might have been. What did it do to you?
Well, it went through my upper lobe of my right lung, broke my scapula, destroyed my third rib. And I ended up having part of my lung removed, but I still have bullet fragments left. I ended up having an x-ray a few years later for something else, and the tech said that there's definitely some metal left in there. But
and you were so. In the hospital 10 days before you awakened.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about those 10 days?
Well, I know my two sons and my stepdaughter actually went to the hospital that night. It took them quite a few hours to find out where I was at and what was going on, because apparently when there's a gunshot victim, they always keep you nameless until, you know, because they don't want whoever shot you to be able to come in the hospital. And I know the paramedics had to do what's called a chest dart, because I guess what was happening is I was trying to breathe, but I had the hole in the front, I had the hole in the back, and all it was doing was filling my chest with air. And so when they do this chest dart, it's like this really huge gauged needle that they poke into your chest to release all that air. And I guess when that happened, at that point, the police were interviewing my husband, and he thought I was gone. He thought they were just, you know, going through the motions. And when they did that chest start, I started breathing again on my own. And I guess I was gurgling, and he passed out right there, and the police had to take him onto the back deck. And so my kids came. Finally, a chaplain found them in one of the waiting rooms, and he said, you know, it's not looking good. We're giving her about a 10% chance. And so they waited until I got out of surgery. And then my stepdaughter, she wouldn't let my boys see me until she saw me first to make sure that it was okay. And I was doing okay to the point where she allowed them to come in to see me. And I know my brother, my parents, and my kids came in multiple times to see me, and a good friend of mine as well. But in the 6 weeks I was in the hospital, my husband of 20 years never visited me once. And I found out from later that my 15-year-old son actually overheard him tell me in the living room, we were fighting, and I guess he asked, you know, do you really want to die? And, you know, of course I'm crying, and I said, yes, I do. And he looked at me and he said, well, then just do it because I'm tired of you. And after he fell asleep, I stole his keys, got into the safe, loaded the gun, wrapped myself in my favorite Scooby-Doo blanket, laid down in the shower stall, and shot myself. And if it wasn't for my kids, you know, I wouldn't have even made it till the paramedics got there.
So. And you said before we began recording that you actually succeeded in committing suicide, that you died at least once.
Yes. About 7 days into my stay at the hospital, they put a code blue in my notes, and I had to be resuscitated. So, and I guess it was really difficult to get me off all the machines. Like, my blood pressure kept bottoming out, and they'd call my parents and say, I don't know if we're going to be able to get her off, you know. I finally just came out of it. And once I was up the rest of the time I was there. They moved me actually off the surgery recovery floor and sent me up to the psych ward. And I was up there a total of 3 weeks when I actually had to get someone outside the hospital, because the psychiatrist that I had at the hospital was positive that if he let me out, I would do it again.
Did you share their concern? Did you think that you might try again?
Quietly, I was definitely considering it, but I knew that I needed to get out because there was no benefit for me to be there at that point. The classes they were sending me to and all the interviews and appointments, and, you know, it was just making me more angry than it was helpful.
When you first became conscious again, opened your eyes, looked around, who was there?
My mom and my dad.
Had they been constantly there?
You know, I actually spoke to them after the fact, and my mom was scared to death to come see me. My dad finally had to say, Cheryl, this is your daughter. You need to go see her. But she was just scared. And I just happened to wake up. That was the first time I woke up. And they were both sitting in the corner of my room. And I just remember the expression on their face was just something had died, you know, and it was because of me. And I realized that from the very start. I could see it. And no matter how many times I've tried comforting them or talking to them about what happened and how sorry I am, I don't think I'll ever be able to take that back. You know, in fact, they don't even really like to talk about it.
So they have not recovered?
No, I don't think they ever will. I think, you know, the damage that I have is nothing compared to what my family and my close friends feel.
How about your kids? They saved your life.
Yeah, well, they are super happy that I'm still here. But yeah, sometimes they get to the point where it's like, Mom, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I don't want to think about that night. You know, when I had a chance to meet the paramedics back in March, the whole family was like, oh, great, let's all go. And then a couple of days before we were supposed to go, everybody backed out and said, I really don't want to go through that again. I don't want to hear the story again. And so it ended up just being me and my boyfriend going. And it was kind of interesting because I set the entire, you know, day up. And the last couple days before I was supposed to go over, I called and I said, well, you know, my family's decided to back out. You know, it's just going to be me and my boyfriend. And he's like, okay, well, you're Cheryl, right? You're Michelle's mother. And I said, no. And he said, well, aren't you coming to thank them for trying to save your daughter? And so I guess it was quite a shock for a couple of them. They were convinced that I was dead and that my mom was just coming to thank them for trying.
Oh, my goodness. Let's back up to your earlier years. Where were you raised?
I was born and raised in Port Angeles. Uh-huh. Went to high school there. I was a great student, you know, cheerleader. And it definitely wasn't where people saw me going. But I've probably had depression ever since I was an early teenager.
Did you generally have, would you say, a typically happy childhood?
Yeah. Yeah, I was spoiled. And
and what did you enjoy doing as a child?
Oh, well, I had the rebellious teenage years where, you know, I went out to all the parties and everything. But I liked to dance. And I was kind of a loner at home. I didn't hang out a lot with, you know, girls. I always seemed to gravitate to guys because I was, you know, I just didn't want to talk about girl things. I wanted to learn about how to fix your car and, you know.
Did you do sports in high school?
I did.
So didn't. Cheerleader, you said, though.
Cheerleader.
Which is athletic for sure.
Yeah, for 1 year I was a cheerleader.
Uh-huh. And didn't go to college?
I went to a travel agent school in Arizona and started working at a hotel there. But other than that, no, I really didn't go to college. And I was ready to get married and have kids. So,
how old were you when your first child was born?
24.
Uh-huh. From your early teens, you sometimes were depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a part of your life ever since.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do to address the symptoms?
I didn't do much in high school, but when my first son was born, I had really bad postpartum depression. And so at that point, that's when I started taking antidepressants. And it just proceeded to get worse. And I think my marriage probably was over after about 5 years. But I always thought, you know, you get married, it's for life. So I stuck with it for 20. And I think that's one of the main reasons I got worse. Was just being there in that relationship. It was not a good place.
And before May 11th, 2013, had you contemplated suicide?
I'd actually tried multiple times. In fact, I spent a week at St. Joseph's the month before in April for a suicide attempt. But usually it wasn't, you know, I wasn't waving a gun around all the time. It was, you know, taking too much medication, that sort of thing. And my husband was positive it was just for attention. So he never showed up to any of the couples or family meetings that they wanted to have. He just left me there for a week and then would send somebody to come pick me up and I'd go back home and it would just get worse. So,
well, that was 4 years ago that you committed suicide, as you put it.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing now?
I got to the point where I did kind of want to reach out, and I think I signed up on Facebook, and a friend from high school got in touch with me, and he ended up taking me out. Well, he drove me to my now boyfriend's. He had a auto detail shop and reintroduced me to Darren. You know, I hadn't seen him since high school, and we fell in love just in weeks. It was so fast. And we've been together ever since, you know, engaged to be married, and my kids are doing well. I now have grandkids. I work at Big Lots in Port Angeles. I really enjoy, you know, the work that I do there.
What is Big Lots?
It's like a Fred Meyer.
Ah, uh-huh.
Yeah. And so I really enjoy that. You know, before I shot myself, I actually worked in doctor's offices, and it was actually more stressful for me. I'm the kind of person where if somebody comes in and they're upset or they're in pain, I just soak up emotion like a sponge. And being in those situations, I was going home every night upset because, you know, this patient had this happen or that, you know, and I was bringing it home with me. So now that I'm at a place that's just happy all the time, you know, we're the whole store is decorated in Christmas stuff. I'm covered in glitter for the next 2 months, you know, that sort of thing. It's a lot more fun.
I'm wondering, you talked about yourself as being kind of a loner, and yet your present life has you being quite sociable. I wonder if that's a change or if you needed to push yourself out of the house more often than you did.
I do spend a lot of time at home. I love watching movies. And one of the things that relaxes me now is coloring. Those really fancy adult coloring books I like, that relaxes me. So I do that while I'm watching TV. I do get out, you know, but not as often and not for as long. I do get stressed out easier than I used to. And being in big groups of people, just too much input, you know.
So you said that depression has not left you entirely. Mm-hmm. How do you address it?
Well, I have a really good doctor right now and a really good therapist. And they're working with me, tweaking my medication. And I see the therapist once a week. She's teaching me how to meditate. And she's going to start doing something called EMDR. And I'm not quite sure what that is, but I guess it brings up past traumas, you know, anything from a little kid on up. So that's something that we're going to work on in the future. But just having somebody that truly cares about me, like my doctor and my therapist do, it really helps to be able to go and talk to them, you know, once a week and get things off my chest when I'm really stressed out. And then, of course, having my spouse, you know, I can talk to him about anything, and we spend every waking minute together. So that's a plus, too.
And his name is Darren, and he says I can talk to him, too.
So. Absolutely. If you wouldn't mind, I think it's important that Michelle touch on, a lot of people said, you know, oh, my God, how could you do that with your children in the house? And the other being how she was treated at a former job at a doctor's office by her employer. If she wouldn't mind talking about that, I think that's important to get those points out.
Yeah, well, the day before, actually, that I shot myself, not my immediate boss, but the boss over her, actually came in that afternoon, pulled me aside, took me to the break room, and she proceeded to tell me, I'm sorry, but you're upsetting the other co-workers. We don't want you crying at work. We don't want you talking about your depression. You just got to leave it at home. And she made me cry, and that's what I took home with me that night. To be working in a doctor's office, to not have them care enough to even try and get me help. So I had no support at work either. And like I said, I didn't have any support at home. And so I never had support at either place. I've run into a lot of anger about that, and I'm angry at myself about it as well. But if you know how bad you can get with depression, you see things like tunnel vision. And all I could see is my kids seeing me crying all the time, fighting with their dad. I was always upset. And I had convinced myself that, you know, if I kill myself and nobody has to deal with me anymore, they'll all be better off. And that really isn't the case, you know, but honest to God, that was all I could see. And the reason that I had my kids there is I wanted to die, but on the other hand, I was scared to die, and I wanted to be with the people I cared about the most. I was just scared. And so that was the only reason. And now, after, you know, everybody's told me what happened in the hours and days after that, if my kids hadn't been there and my husband was the only one there, he would have left me to die, you know. So them being there was actually the reason I was able to survive. So
looking back on the day when you committed suicide and maybe the days and weeks leading up to it, what could people have done to have kept you from taking that action?
At that point, the only person that probably could have helped me was my husband, and he didn't want to help. So I really don't know that anybody could have stopped me. I would have figured out a way.
Because you tried before, and you really were wanting not to be living any longer.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much maybe for your own pain that you were experiencing, but what you thought you were putting other people through?
It was both. Mm-hmm. Because I spent 24 hours a day thinking about death. I mean, when you're driving to work and you think, oh, if I hit that railing, you know, at such and such a speed, that would work, you know, or no, I could do this, or, you know, it got to the point where everywhere I went, that was all I thought about. And like I said, I was crying 24 hours a day. You really only see one thing, and that's pain. And that's all you think about is I'm in pain and I'm causing pain. And if I wasn't here, you know, and it's just, it's like a circle and the thoughts just spin around in your brain and, you know, because you just can't get out of that thought pattern. And
what do you do now when, I will say, the black mist comes towards you? How do you fight it off?
Well, if I'm having a really bad day, Darren notices right away. And he'll talk to me. You know, I can contact my therapist. I just have a lot of people around me now that understand how bad it got for me, and they don't want to ever see that happen again. I have a wonderful employer now that doesn't hold it against me when I feel that I'm getting so depressed that I don't feel I can go to work. You know, she's so supportive. Every time I see her, she gives me a hug. And it's really nice to have a boss that works with me. So that makes a big difference.
So Darren, move into the microphone again, please. I've sort of been watching you out of the corner of my eye, and we did talk before we began recording, and I can tell that Michelle means a great deal to you. What have you learned from her?
Well, I learned that true love does exist, for one. I never thought that I would ever meet somebody with such a huge heart and the most loving, giving person I've ever met. She's just amazing, and thank God that
she we saved each other.
Yeah, I gotta say, it's we both were in a place where, you know, didn't think we needed to be in a relationship and weren't looking for one, but as soon as we met, it was the fireworks, I guess.
Then you'd known each other in high school.
We did. I had a crush on Michelle in high school, but she was dating one of my friends, so what are you going to do? But, I was, 42 or something when we met, and the last 4 years have just been the best of my life.
Does it ever get hard for you, though, with Michelle's depression, especially when it becomes most acute?
I guess it's hard in that I feel a little helpless. Sometimes I wish I could do more, but just being there, what I have learned, just being there and having somebody to listen to her, I think that's huge. And to be in that desperate a state and not have somebody there listening, I just can't imagine what that must have been like. And we'll be there to listen if anybody does need to talk to somebody. She would be the one to talk to, for sure.
I've been bringing it up on a regular basis that I wish I could figure out a way to help other people. And I think, you know, we had the three jumpers off the bridge, and it was like the first one, I was like, God, what can I do? And the third one being, she actually had a class with my soon-to-be stepson, and that hit me a lot harder. Her age and the fact that we knew her indirectly, that was really upsetting because I felt if I had stopped saying I'd like to help and actually tried to do something about it, I might have been able to help her. And that's why I gave people my email address. And I actually had a gentleman contact me a couple days after I was in the paper and said, you know, I have a friend that's in crisis. Would you be willing to talk to him? And I actually went to his house. Darren and I both went. And we were there for about an hour and a half. And, you know, he's doing much better.
Do you think that helping others is therapy for you?
It is, because, like I said, there's nothing I can do to take back what I did. But I feel if I could just help one person, you know, to show people that it can be done, when I honestly, I mean, let me tell you, when you wake up in the hospital after shooting yourself, my first thought was, wow, I can't do anything right, you know. And now I found happiness. You know, I have a wonderful relationship. My kids are doing good. You know, my granddaughter, who was only 9 months old when I shot myself, she's now 5. She's in school. Now I have a grandson. He's 3. And, you know, life is wonderful now.
Are you confident that the urge to take your life is behind you forever?
Yes. I would never do that to my family and friends again. I can actually see it from both sides now. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to atone for, because I just can't take it back. And those people will always feel that. My mom, if she gets a late night phone call, that's the first thing she thinks of. You know, same with my kids. If I just call out of the blue and, you know, or I don't sound good on the phone, or, you know, that's the first thing they're thinking. And it consumes everybody after a while, where all they're worried about is, what's Michelle going to do? And so now, no, I wouldn't ever do that.
So talking with you, you're articulate, intelligent, and you've had quite a range of experiences. And one in particular, you seem like you're a born counselor. Have you thought about getting into that as a professional field?
You know, we've actually talked about it before. But like I said, I absorb, you know, if I'm in a room of a bunch of upset people, I have an anxiety attack because I absorb emotion. You know, if somebody's upset or sad or mad, or, you know, I can feel their pain. So, yeah, I would love to help. But like right now, just me helping people by putting my email out there, I was like, God, what if I try to help somebody and they still commit suicide? I'm going to blame myself. And I don't know that I could be a counselor. I mean, I would love to talk with people if, you know, if they need me, but I don't think I could be a counselor. It'd be too hard.
And so. But nevertheless, you have put yourself out there, seeing your email address in newspaper and mm-hmm. perhaps a Facebook page as well. Mm-hmm. Do you have a Facebook page where people can find you?
I do.
Okay. And can you tell us how to find that?
Oh, I'm Michelle Fox, and my email address is mfmcfly@hotmail.com. And, you know, if somebody contacts me and they want to meet with me, or, you know, have me talk to someone, meet somebody at the emergency room, or somebody's in crisis, yes, absolutely. I'm not going to say no.
Thank you for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
Inspirational
thank you
for
having
me. You're welcome. And Darren, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And I didn't get your last name.
Nikovich.
Darren Nikovich. Yep. It is. And Michelle Fox, it's mm-hmm. been a good time together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans and Phil Andrus,
and originally aired in December of 2017.
The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.